everyone, and welcome to Sped Homeschool Conversations. We are so glad to have you here with us again on our every Tuesday night broadcast that we have to talk about special education homeschooling and just ways that parents can learn and grow as they teach their kids and help them in those areas that they're struggling in, because we know that there are a lot of areas that curriculum doesn't cover, and we as parents kind of have to fill in those gaps. And we're going to talk a lot about that tonight as well. But this broadcast is put on every week by Sped Homeschool. We are a nonprofit that is just here to support parents with resources to help them homeschool successfully children who struggle academically, socially, behaviorally, the whole bit. So we're kicking off this month. Every month we do a different topic, and the topic that we're focusing on for the month of September is reading. And we're going to kind of go broader than that today, but when our guest talks about this, you'll understand why. And so our guest tonight is Dr. Daniel Franklin, and he is the author of Helping Your Child with Language-Based Learning Disabilities, and it's this book right here. So welcome, Daniel, and thank you for being with us tonight.
Well, thank you. I'm delighted to be here and delighted to be taking questions from your guests and from you.
Yes, definitely. If you're joining us, if you have questions about anything, if your student's struggling, especially as we kind of dive into this, Daniel's going to give us an overview of what language-based learning disabilities are. And the topic that we're going to focus on tonight is supporting your child with language-based learning disabilities and what you can do as a parent to really help children who struggle with all these, this mix of things that's going on that we often don't understand. I know as I was reading your book, I'm going, if I had only known all of this, that your book is like a summary of what everybody has taught me over the years. And it was just, it's like an encyclopedia. I highly recommend purchasing it. So, well, I would like our audience to get to know you a little bit. And if I thought maybe if you could just share a little bit of your professional background and what you do on a regular basis, that'd be a great way to get started.
Well, it's a pleasure, and I'm delighted to speak about my professional background. And Peggy, as you know, my personal background is also highly relevant to our conversation
yes.
tonight and the topic of my book. My professional background involves over 35 years as a teacher, primarily a special education teacher, as an educational consultant, as an educational therapist. I hold a master's degree in reading, language, and learning disabilities from the Harvard Graduate School of Education, and a PhD from UCLA in education. But my real learning took place working with students, working with parents like you, Peggy, and being in the real world, in classrooms, working one-on-one with children who are struggling at school, and just being very involved and immersed in the various communities I participate in.
Yeah, so, I love how you share in your book so many examples, because I think that that draws in the reality. It's not just educational philosophy. This is real life, hit the ground running. We, you know, this is a child's life. And I mean, that's what we deal with. And we don't want to hear just the hypothetical. We want to hear how it works. And so I thank you for that and sharing those examples.
Absolutely. It is real life. And there are, often we get pulled in directions that frankly aren't as real life as might be optimal. And so I try very hard to be practical and grounded and relevant by not being too theoretical and too abstract. And I strive very hard to think of things and offer suggestions that are practical and easy to apply and use.
Yeah,
I mentioned that there's both a professional and a personal aspect of my work. Peggy, did you want me to share a little bit about my own?
I do. I mean, that's how when I first met you, before I even read your book, you had me watch that YouTube video, the documentary done on you. And it was very eye-opening too. And I'd love for you to share a bit of that story with us.
Sure. The documentary, Unteachable, created by the filmmaker Anthony Sharon. It's something that's easy to access on YouTube or at my various websites, and so we'd be happy to share that with your viewers. Peggy, as you know, I struggled terribly as a child learning to read, write, spell, do mathematics, and a lot of my struggles began to spill over into my behavior as well.
Which we see so often.
I frankly didn't even have rudimentary literacy skills until I was in fifth or sixth grade. I was unable to spell my entire name until fifth grade. And learning, especially learning written language, was enormously challenging for me. It was a very slow, difficult process. I loved learning. I had two very caring parents who believed in me. Indeed, it's the care and love of parents that really means the most to children who struggle at school. And my parents never put school performance above their love and care for me. So even though I had siblings who were achieving at a very high level, whereas I was not, my parents never allowed that to undermine the quality of my relationship with them. And that was one of the main saving graces of my life. And they fostered a real interest in learning. And so I was really concerned about being a learner and a good learner. And in time, I did acquire very good reading skills and writing skills and other academic skills. So those are sort of the two pieces of the puzzle here, my professional and my personal journey.
Yeah. I mean, just with the credentials you have and knowing that you didn't read or write till fifth grade, a lot of people, you know, they just kind of give up and say, well, it's just not going to happen. You're not going to be able to accomplish this. But to have that supportive parents that were willing to just cheer you on wherever you were at, that had to have been encouraging to you to just keep trying. And I know there were educators in your life too that stepped in and were those encouragements you needed as well.
Amazing educators, one in particular, Mrs. Shirley Gott, who was my fifth and sixth grade teacher. She was the first person to step forward and not allow my struggles at school to underline my faith in myself and my capacity to learn. And I remain friends with her throughout her entire life. She only passed away a few years ago at the age of 98. And I remained in touch with her throughout her entire lifetime.
That's amazing. Just have those people in your life. And I know we remember them. We remember their names because they're important to us. And they are those, our cheerleaders. And it's good to have those for your kids. You know, you be a cheerleader, but have other people speaking into their lives too. I know we talked about this in our interview last week, especially with teenagers who don't always believe you when you tell them things about themselves. And
They might not believe us, but if we always show optimism, they will feel that.
Yes.
Children, teens, young adults, they know optimism. They know when someone is optimistic towards them. And I've never seen any child harmed by the optimism that's been shown in them. And so when we can be optimistic, and of course, our own optimism in ourselves and what it is we're trying to do is critical for young people, children, teens, young adults to also experience our optimism. So we must be optimistic about ourselves and what we're doing, and also have optimism in the children, teens, and young adults, even the ones who struggle, especially the ones who struggle.
Yeah.
Because they're the ones who need to know that we're optimistic.
So true. Yes. Because they lose that optimism on their own, and they need somebody to have it for them sometimes and share it and encourage them to keep going. So that's great. I think, you know, and that's what fuels what you do. And I know that. Because you understand these kids from what it's like to be them. And that's why you push yourself to do what you do. And there's so many of us that are in those roles. We've either worked with a child that has had difficulties, and that's why we do, you know, we help other parents. We've struggled ourselves, and so it shows in just the caring attitude you have in what you do. And so that's, and I'm sure our audience is going to learn more about, see more of that tonight as we talk. But once again, if you have comments, questions as we're going along, make sure you put them in the feed, just like the Be Live lets you know that we can see them and include them in our conversation. So what do you mean when you talk about language-based learning disabilities?
That's a really great question. And it's a great question because 30 or 40 years ago, as people began to realize bright, capable kids were really struggling to learn, and wanted to know why, they began to look at these students closer and try to get a more detailed picture of what was going on. Mm-hmm. 30 or 40 years ago, we just had really a large group of kids. We called them kids with learning disabilities. But as time went on, we began to say, well, yes, but for some, it's really a reading disability. For others, it's a significant attentional issue. Or for others, a processing disorder. Or for others still, it's really some slowly emerging communication skills, language skills, even social skills. Mm. And we began to develop lots of subtypes, which in many respects is good. We want to have a more detailed picture. So subtypes are good. However, almost all learning and behavioral differences co-occur with something else. For example, about 20% of all children who have a primary diagnosis of ADHD also have a secondary diagnosis of a specific learning disability in the area of reading or dyslexia. And interestingly, about 20% of all children who have are diagnosed as having a specific learning disability in the area of reading or dyslexia can also be identified as having ADHD. We know other issues, for example, autism and ADHD co-occur very, very frequently. Mm-hmm. So it's important for us to realize if there has been an identified learning challenge, invariably there's going to be some other issues. Now, Peggy, I see you put up a Venn diagram that's in my book. Is it possible to make it larger for your viewers? Can it be the whole screen?
We can take the two of us off and we'll just talk and...
Sure, that might be helpful.
Okay, so we're going to turn cameras off on both of us, but yet our audio should still be here.
I can hear you. And okay. I think that seems pretty good.
There we go.
Okay. Great. So in this Venn diagram, this is in my book.
Yeah.
You can see how things such as dyslexia or a reading disability or dysgraphia, the writing version of dyslexia, or dyscalculia, which is a math form of dyslexia, how they co-occur with ADHD and executive functioning delays.
Yes.
And how dyslexia and ADHD also co-occur with auditory and visual processing delays. Mm-hmm. So almost always when we're helping a struggling student, we it's important not to get too fixated on one issue and think more globally about the many other co-occurring challenges that the child might also have. We know that children with dyslexia really struggle to process spoken language. It's not just a reading disability, it's also a comprehension challenge. Mm-hmm. In other words, dyslexia is not about not having well-developed reading comprehension skills. It's more about having slowly developing comprehension skills in general. And so we really want to think about a much more comprehensive approach to supporting children, teens, and young adults with any one, and frankly, it's always almost always a combination of these various learning and behavioral differences.
Yeah, too often we are siloing those different diagnoses and looking at the one perspective. But I, you know, oftentimes now we're hearing parents who are coming with all these different diagnoses together, and that's basically what you're showing in this chart, is that there is that crossover that we need to be aware of, that they do affect one another as well as come together.
And interestingly, 1 year, one set of issues might be more pronounced, and another year, another set of issues. I've seen some children who may have a primary diagnosis of ADHD and a secondary diagnosis of dyslexia have struggle with ADHD. The following year or two or 3 years later, it's really the dyslexia that is creating more challenges than the ADHD. And so it's not linear, it's not concrete, it's not rigid. There's a lot of back and forth and up and down and between all of these learning and behavioral differences.
That's amazing. And the other diagram that that you gave me that I wanted to talk about too while we're on this subject is the skill development discrepancy, because we so badly want to catch our children up. I can't tell you how often I hear that, and I'm sure you do too. Can you address that a bit with children who have these struggles and the idea of a quick fix?
Sure. Is it possible, Peggy, to make that image a little bit larger for your viewers?
We're going to have to bring our images back down again. Unfortunately, I don't have the ability to change.
Okay. That. Well,
I can try a couple different. No, it only gives me a couple different options. And unfortunately, they don't allow that screen to get bigger. So, okay, we'll do this again.
Oh, there you go. That's quite good, Peggy. So what this graph shows is the straight line going from the lower left corner up to the top right. It's sort of a theoretical trajectory of skill development.
Exactly.
But with the children we work with in special education, children with learning and behavioral differences, they tend to have delays in many different areas. Incidentally, this graph can represent any skill. It could be reading or writing or math. It could be attention or even various types of social skills.
Right.
So it's important to note that these delays can frequently grow, increase as a child gets older. And that is why we also need to think about, we often call it two separate but parallel tracks of supporting children. One is we need to come up with bypass strategies to support a child at school if their reading skills are emerging really slowly. We need
We're going to talk about that in a little while.
Okay. So let me then focus on the main theme of this graph, which is these learning and behavioral differences can actually increase relative to peers as these children get older. The good news is, with appropriate help and support, as these children age increases, we can begin to close that gap, sometimes quite substantially. Right. And that's why this graph represents a divergence at the outset, a growing skill delay increase, and then closing the gap as these children become teens and young adults. And that this graph would represent me very well, that my skill level relative to my classmates and peers got considerably bigger. My skill was much more delayed relative to my peers as I got into junior high and high school. But in time, I became increasingly skilled in all areas of reading, writing, processing, and eventually was able to, with considerable effort and not perfectly at first, but I did get into college, and with hard work and a lot of wonderful support, was able to perform well in college. And actually it was in my college years that I really developed skill as a reader and writer, skill in terms of important study skills and test-taking strategies and so forth. And so things do work out with enough support and care and faith.
Right. And I think that is such a good visual. We talk a lot of times about going at your child's own pace, but to see it on a graph like that, at least for me, who I'm a visual learner, that it just hit home to me that my son has been on that track, the one who's still living at home and, you know, working. And I talked to you about this before we started, and he's having these aha moments now in his young adult, you know, he's 20 and a half, and we're seeing that catch up. And it's amazing to with the right encouragement and just not getting him down. And my husband's even, you know, talks to him every once in a while about, well, you know, you put college out of there, but maybe you should kind of think about it again, you know, and just revisiting just different things that he didn't feel like he had the skills for at a certain time, but maybe down the road that pace has caught up a bit.
Time helps a lot. Mm-hmm. Individuals, and I'm an example, my skill development was delayed significantly relative to peers. And it can be a real problem if, as a child, you begin to internalize those delays as meaning you're a failure or not a capable learner or not a good person. And this is why the love and faith and conviction that parents have for struggling learners is so essential in order for these children to overcome the challenges they're experiencing as younger children.
Exactly.
I can almost feel my skill set changing in college. And incidentally, I did not go from high school to college. I took an additional year of high school, a fifth year of high school, if you will, at a boarding school that offered a postgraduate year of high school. My skill set really wasn't sufficient for me to manage the demands of college right out of high school. Mm. And the postgraduate year, or that fifth year of high school, although I did learn a lot of skills and benefited in many ways, it was really just the sheer maturation that I believe was the most important factor. So we really want to buy young adults time and allow them to mature and develop so that the capacities they need to manage these challenging demands of college have arrived. The prefrontal cortex, the region of the brain directly under the forehead, for most individuals is not fully developed until about the age of 25. The prefrontal cortex is the area of the brain we need for volitional behavior, for paying attention, and for regulating emotion, and for problem solving even under stress, and for using our brains flexibly so we know how to organize our thoughts when we have to write, or how a strategy for processing the material we're reading. Mm-hmm. A well-developed prefrontal cortex is essential for all of those things, and it's not fully developed till most individuals are 25 years old. And so a lot of these young people who are struggling, it's really no fault of their own. It's just that the demands exceed where they're at developmentally. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot we can do as parents and teachers and educators to help children, teens, and young adults manage these complex, overwhelming demands while these capacities are developing and coming online.
Yeah. And the thing that I loved about what you stressed in your book, and I kind of want to segue into that, is relationship. And what does it mean to have, and I know we touched a little bit on this at the very beginning when you were talking about your story, but what can we do as parents to help our children be more successful? And I know it's all tied into that relationship. And what does that look like, though?
It starts with us as adults, whether we're teachers or parents or anybody else, a coach or a clergy or anybody else. We must start with belief in ourselves, faith in ourselves, because that's where it all starts. And once we are confident in who we are and what we're doing, we can then help young people, teens, young adults, to realize that sometimes the demands exceed what they're capable of at that moment, but mm-hmm. with help, they can succeed. But young people really are only able and willing to take help from people they trust and care about.
Yes.
And so when we focus on the quality of our relationship and put that ahead of other considerations, certainly in the early stages, that's one of the ways we can really help a teen, young adult mm-hmm. manage these situations that can sometimes exceed their capacities. The human brain is a social organ. It only develops well in the context of good relationships. Any person who has not had access to other good brains doesn't develop a good brain of their own. And so we really want to leverage this reality of what a human brain is, that it's an organ that needs another fully developed brain to develop and grow and function well. And that it's the social nature of humans that we really want to leverage when we're helping children learn and manage demands. Mm-hmm. What do I mean by social? By it's learning together, solving problems together, managing demands together as a team, working together collaboratively, mm-hmm. and not pathologizing the need for help. You know, Peggy, you've probably heard me say this before. The difference between a helicopter parent and a helpful parent is
yeah.
A helicopter parent provides help that's not needed. A helpful parent provides help that is needed.
Yeah.
And children, teens, and young adults with language-based learning disabilities need a lot of help. Mm-hmm. So you're not being a helicopter parent if you're providing help that is needed.
Yeah. Yeah. That is, it's so true. It's a relationship, but then it's the constant access to help. And I mean, I was even talking to my daughter, who tends to do rather good at things, but we were talking about her having to write research papers this year. And I said, I will walk through that with you. And you could just see this relief coming over her. Yeah. I'm like, oh, okay. If you're going to walk through this with me, then it won't be so bad. But to know that they have somebody to lean on those things that they don't yet understand, instead of just dumping it on our kids. And too often I interact with parents who are like, just give me a curriculum that's going to solve my child's problems. But you're the one who's going to solve your child's problems being there. And that it's such a hard bridge to come across in a society where we just want a quick fix. And I love in your book how you say this is not a quick fix. This is not an easy thing. This takes a lot of commitment and a lot of your time.
That's right. My book isn't a three easy steps to you know, your high achieving independent student. Mm-hmm. My book is about what can we do as a family and as a community? How can we work together and with one another to help children, teens, and young adults with a wide range of learning and behavioral differences manage demands that exceed their capacities? How can we work together to build up their confidence, their self-esteem, their belief in themselves, and their belief in us, so that they know that getting help when you need it is not only okay, it's great, it's desirable.
It is. Well, we live in a society now where collaboration is more important than it ever has been before. We don't silo ourselves in businesses and even in just the work that we do. And I love how you pointed out even professional writers have editors and have, you know, collaborators that put into their writings. And we have pushed that out of our education system and say, just do it all yourself. You have to do this project on your own. And yet we're preparing our children for places where they need that skill.
Learning how to get help, accept help, and give help mm-hmm. is a critical skill in of itself. Increasingly, NASA looks for collaborators. 40, 50 years ago, they were looking for Han Solo, who was going to do it on his own. But those are not the individuals they're currently seeking. And this is true of many leading corporations and many organizations. We're looking for people who've learned to get help, to give help, to work collaboratively. And we can teach this critical capacity every single day right at home in finding good, positive, constructive ways to work with children and teens and young adults too.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I liked it. One of my neighbors asked if I would tutor her son. And the first thing she said is, I just want you to meet him and him to meet you to see if it's going to work. Because she knew instinctively that it was the relationship between the two of us that was going to make this math tutoring thing work. And so he came over and he has some language issues. And I sat down with him and kind of tested him a little bit. And he just beamed after we left. And I saw him the other day. I walked into a dance studio where he takes tap and I do some dance and he's like, Miss Peggy. And I could tell this is going to be a good year because we've already connected, you know, and that relationship has started because he's excited about just the relationship of us working together in math. And, that's really what it takes. And so, yeah, love that. So the complexity of reading. I don't think we understand this. And oftentimes it's quoted that the two most stressful times for a homeschool parent is when they're teaching their child to read and when they enter high school. Because there's so many things involved. And you do a really good job. You've got a diagram in your book. And I know you wanted to talk about this, but just of all the different things that are involved in the reading process that we need to be aware of. And not say, well, we're just following the curriculum and they're not getting it. And I think your diagram tells a lot of why.
It's a wonderful diagram. That's the Reading Rope by Hollis Scarborough. It is also in my book. And it's just a lovely way to understand all the threads and capacities that are required to become a skilled reader. It's important to remember that while a child is learning to read, they cannot use reading to learn. In other words, until you're a skilled reader, reading is not an efficient and often not even a good way to acquire information and to learn concepts.
Right.
This is why, while a child is learning to read, we want to provide them with enormous level of support. We want to read the material aloud to them. Sometimes we just want to read the material ourselves and explain to their child, teen, even the young adult, what it means. The point is, they need the information. Do they need to learn to read too? Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah.
But we need to do that at a different time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I was just having that discussion with my daughter tonight, is that we've been using this curriculum that has almost like a textbook feel for the history. And I said to her, I said, we're not going to do that this year because I read it, you listen to it, and neither of us understand it. Yeah. It really is not making sense. There has to be another way we can figure out what, you know, the information that we need to get in each section. But yeah.
So this is why it's so important for parents to be actively involved in their child's learning. And sometimes we want the parent to really look at what the learning objectives are, make sure the parent understands them.
Right.
And the parent can come up with a set of strategies to convey that content and teach that content, because we don't want a slowly emerging skill like reading to interfere with the child from grasping those concepts.
Mm-hmm.
If I may use a personal example, much of my learning as a child was from my parents. I would come home with content that I was required to learn and ask my mother and father, well, what were the Punic Wars about? Or what are the different types of scientific phenomena? Can you explain this to me? Or tell me a little bit about these different writers from different periods of literature, and they would just tell me the stories and provide me with information. And this is how I learned and acquired information. And in time, I did become a skilled reader and a skilled writer. But I if you're not a skilled reader and writer and you're not getting the help you need when you're in school, right, unfortunately, you're really going to struggle. But the good news is there's lots we can do to help these kids, these teens, these young adults learn and not struggle quite as much and feel optimistic about their ability to be successful as a student.
Right. So yeah, in your book, you talk a lot about, you know, supplementing different information that maybe isn't provided with the curriculum, but could mean the same thing or get the same information in, using scaffolding, which I know we talk about on our website. A couple of our team members are educators. I'm not. So they talk about that in their blogs. And then just collaboration, like we've been talking about, you know, that relationship, that going back and forth and really being a partner with your student. You have some graphs on different ways to give support to your student in both reading and writing. And I know you shared those with me. So I'm going to put up the reading one and just kind of let you talk about that pyramid and what does that actually mean?
So if a student has slowly emerging reading skills, but they need to acquire content that's bound up, contained in written text,
yeah,
we need to get that information out of there and into the student's head.
Right. And that's what we need. They need the most.
They need the information. Mm-hmm. They don't need to struggle with a task that is beyond the scope of what they can do.
Yeah.
So levels of reading support. At the highest level of reading support, we want to read the material ourselves. And then we want to explain what it says.
Mm-hmm.
We want to explain what it says. We want to create some illustrations. We want to find some resources on the internet. We want to read some sections aloud. And so it's a very scaffolded approach to reading support. The next level down is reading the material aloud to the student. Now, with many individuals with dyslexia, it's not just a reading disability, it's a comprehension issue. So this is why books on tape have not been the panacea for individuals with dyslexia.
Exactly. That was the issue with my son too. I give him a book and he'd like, I didn't understand it. And so I was like, oh, okay. We have to find another way to do this.
That's right. If books on tape were the panacea for dyslexia, dyslexia would have gone away as soon as there were books on tape.
Yeah.
But the problem is dyslexia is more than a reading disability. There's lots of areas of comprehension and certain types of memory, especially in the area of sequence, that are also impacted. And so simply reading aloud doesn't always solve all of the challenges individuals with dyslexia have. So if we are going to read aloud, we still want to provide illustrations and diagrams and timelines and other ways of visualizing the information. The next level down is have the student read aloud. Now, it's useful to have students read aloud because when they read aloud, they often, especially if their reading skills are emerging slowly, they tend to read with more accuracy. And reading aloud is also a way, in some instances, of improving or enhancing a student's reading skill. But reading aloud, again, does not address all of the comprehension issues that a child with dyslexia might have. And at the very lowest level, it's having a student read silently and check for understanding.
Mm-hmm.
If we are having a child, teen, a young adult, read silently on their own, we want to provide them with an opportunity to share with us what they read and check to see if they understood it clearly and thoroughly. Mm-hmm. And if not, we want to clarify and provide some reinforcement. So those are the levels of reading support. And Peggy, this might be a good time for us to share with your viewers the levels of writing support.
Yes, I will bring that up. Let me bring this one down. Okay. And I'll bring that one up. Here we go. So yeah, writing is Like so, we talked about at the beginning, there's a lot of combinations of the same types of things, but some ways to support that.
That's right. And they follow similar types of support. But before I go too far into describing levels of writing support, very often when I'm presenting to parents or teachers or groups of educators or clinicians, I will say, who has ever sat down to dash off a quick 30-second email and 30 minutes later, you're composing a much longer, more developed email? And yes, people frequently laugh because we've all done that.
Mm-hmm.
We're doing, and we do that because we can, because we're skilled writers. We can use writing as a tool to develop ideas, to refine ideas, to grow ideas. And when we're taking what we thought was going to be a 30-second email and are developing a 30-minute email, we're using writing as a thinking tool, and we can because we're skilled writers. But a child or an unskilled writer can't do that. They're not skilled enough to use writing this way, this flexible way. That's why, much like reading support, we want to offer a high level of scaffolded writing support. So at the highest level, we want to engage in a lot of collaboration. We want to talk with a child or a teen or even a young adult. Well, what is it we want to write about? Mm-hmm. What are some areas that we want to include? What about this question? How about this idea? And we want to begin to take notes on what they're saying. We want to begin to create some ways of visualizing how to order the information. Sometimes a bunch of boxes that look like train cars with different ideas in them, or sometimes a spider web or some other kind of form or shape might make a good template in which to begin to put the information, talking about a topic sentence or a topic or an introductory paragraph are all things we want to actively engage in and participate in. Now, questions of authorship often come up when we're providing high levels of writing support, especially in this way. That's why it's important to keep notes, keep our own notes, and keep all the notes and illustrations that we're using when we're working with a child, so we can sit down with a child's teacher to explain the process we use to help a child manage a writing demand. We never want a child to submit work that they don't feel they have ownership of. But when we work with a child and some of the diagrams they created and they feel put some words in, or we can say, this idea was dictated to me by my son or my daughter or the student with whom I'm working. So we want to keep detailed notes on what our process is, so that the process and authorship can be clearly explained and justified. The next level down might just be offering frequent prompts and some guidance. So we might not be as actively participating as we are at the highest level there, at the top of the pyramid.
Mm-hmm.
Further down, there might be fewer prompts and guidance, but we still want to provide lots of availability and encouragement, of course. And at the lowest level of writing support, the student will do all of the writing and we'll do some proofreading. We'll check for grammar and sentence structure and punctuation and appropriate vocabulary use and so forth. So this is how the levels of writing support and the levels of reading support parallel one another. Mm-hmm. And much like I described earlier, that while you're learning to read, you cannot use reading to learn. So while we're learning to read, reading is not a good means of acquiring information. Mm-hmm. You have to be a skilled reader to efficiently extract information from a written text and to retain it and process it and utilize it. In a similar vein, while a child is learning to write, they cannot use writing to learn, like writing that more well-developed email that started off as a 30-second email we were gonna dash off, ended up as a 30-minute well-developed explanation of whatever it is that we're including in our email. And so while there's this process of learning to read and reading to learn And there's a process of learning to write and writing to learn. And we need to realize that these are slow processes, and they are processes that for some students, especially students with language-based learning disabilities, need a lot of explicit help with.
Right. Yeah. And going back to that, what you had talked about, it's, you know, if it's an appropriate help, it's not a helicopter. It's what the support that they really need. And so you're not cheating. I think a lot of parents say I'm giving my student help, but no, you're not. You're giving them the proper support. And
you want, as long as you're really clear,
when you dictate, you know, not to change their grammar, to dictate word for word what they give you, because they need to know what they gave you. And oftentimes they don't until they see it written down as how it came out to them.
That's absolutely correct, Peggy. And it's also very encouraging to me how many parents now, and educators too, are beginning to really appreciate these approaches to this learning support and school support.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. It is because I in our generation, I know you talk a little bit about that and just how, you know, people just kind of floated you through. And if you had issues, well, you know, we would supplement here and there with some remediation and call it good. And our parents just expect our schools to figure it out. And when my son was diagnosed on the autism spectrum, my parents are like, well, that was you. And yeah, you know, you realize these things about yourself that you struggle with all your life and then go, why didn't anybody say anything? And it's just because they didn't know. But now we're talking more about this and we're realizing that this happens more than we wanted, you know, really let on, or we used to want to let on, that there isn't a one size fits all education. And there are kids that struggle, and it doesn't mean that they're stupid. It just means that they learn differently, and they need.
Peggy, you really hit the nail on the head. There is not a one-size-fits-all approach, and no two people are the same. No two situations are the same, and we need to be able to customize and support and participate actively in all aspects of learning and development, because we're social creatures. Our brains develop in the context of relationships, and the healthier those relationships are, the healthier those brains are too.
Exactly. Yes. It's so very important. So just for our audience to know, we are taking questions. If you want to put something in the feed, if you have a question, something that's going on with your student and you'd like to ask Dr. Daniel before our time is up, love that. We're just talking about supports that parents can offer to children with language-based learning disabilities, which we talked about at the beginning, talking about how they just all kind of co-occur with each other. And it's not like your child just has dyslexia and that's it, because you'll often see these other things crop up. but to be able to just support them. And I think that's, you know, a lot of what we're talking about is these different supports and being able to figure it out specifically what your child needs to make them succeed. And I kind of want to end our time talking a little bit about, if we don't get any questions, we can definitely take your questions and we can skip this subject. But back to high school and the higher levels, you know, we still saw on that chart that you gave us, and I'm going to bring it back up here again, but the skill development discrepancy. Our kids are, you know, hitting that 12th grade, and look at that span. And what do we do as a parent? Maybe we've only just discovered that our child is having issues because the discrepancy has become so large, and it's become up to a point where we can't manage it, they can't manage it anymore, and life looks like it's falling apart. I've heard from many parents about that. What are some suggestions that you have?
Well, there's good news, and I'll speak to that in just a moment. But Peggy, I also wanted to remind your viewers that even if they're not asking questions tonight, they should feel free to ask me a question anytime. And I think you'll share my contact information with your viewers towards the end of our present. Oh, there it is.
There it is.
So I take questions anytime, at all, I'm really easy to reach at danielfranklinphd.com. It's all one, danielfranklinphd.com. I'm really easy to reach. And you can also reach me at my website, franklined.com.
And I know this is true because he answered a call right when we were getting the video set up.
I love my work. I love speaking with parents, with educators, with students, with clinicians. I welcome questions anytime from anybody. And I look forward to collaborating with your viewers in the future.
Definitely.
Getting back to your question, what do we do when a student is in 9th, 10th, 11th, 12th grade, and we're just discovering that there is some very slowly emerging capacity? The good news is this. Almost everything we need to be able to do well, we can learn pretty much any time in our lives. Most skills, unlike learning to speak, for which there is a developmental window that occurs quite early in life, and a few other very specific capacities, most other skills can be learned anytime in life. An individual may never have seen a single printed word or letter until the age of 30. But with proper teaching, they can become a skilled reader and a skilled writer. And there are many examples throughout history of just this phenomena. Individuals who did not have access to any kind of formal education at a very late time in life, becoming very skilled with, say, written language, reading and writing. So that's the good news.
Yeah.
The important thing is, to do when we identify there is a very slowly emerging skill is make sure we're providing the help that is needed to address the obstacles that challenges. I mentioned it earlier, and I'll mention it again. We want to think in terms of two separate but parallel tracks. One track is the bypass strategies, the help that we use, applying the hierarchy of reading support. We want to provide the bypass strategies, the high level of support for reading and writing and organization and time management and planning and even self-advocacy that's required to manage the demands.
Right.
While we're doing all of those things, we can also teach those capacities on a separate track. And in time, children, teens, and young adults will acquire those skills, as long as we continue to provide the help in a caring, compassionate, loving way, because children, teens, and young adults and people in general respond best to this marvelous capacity we've all been blessed with, which is compassion and care and empathy. And those are the greatest resources all of us have, not only to help children, teens, and young adults, but one another. And I think that's one of the important messages I try to communicate in my book.
Definitely. And I want to bring up an image of your book just to show everybody. Get over here. But this is Daniel's book. It's called Helping Your Child with Language-Based Learning Disabilities. And like I said before, it is awesome. It is amazing. You have so much good information in there. And it definitely is written from your heart. It shares examples, it shares technical information, but in a way that somebody who doesn't have a degree in education or any type of, you know, reading, I have no expertise in teaching reading, but it made sense to me when I read through it. And so thank you for making this a parent family-based approach to helping a child instead of just a clinician's approach, because it means a lot to families when they see their kids struggling and they feel like, I can't help them. I need to hire an expert, or, you know, just they leave it all on the expert because I can't do anything as a parent. But you can. And I think that's, your book is very
true. There's a lot parents can do. And my book was a labor of love. I wrote it with wanting to make the idea is easy to access, to understand, to use. My book does not need to be read from chapter 1 to chapter 13, right. Mm-hmm. That you can pick and choose chapters or even sections within chapters. I have included a very comprehensive table of contents to make it easy for parents to look up what it is they need help with in that moment of doing homework, or in that moment of managing a demand at home or at school. And so it's really a book to sort of pick through, really, rather than read cover to cover. It's a guide, it's a resource. It comes with 22 free pages of accessories that the publisher makes available for free. Mm-hmm. And again, I love hearing from people who, in general, but also from any individual who might purchase my book. I would love to hear from you too. My goal is to provide help that's needed to participate in this amazing opportunity that we have to help one another, to help children, teens, and young adults.
Yeah, I think it's going to encourage a lot of families, actually. The ones that I've heard already talking about it, it definitely has, and I think that'll just spread. And it'll definitely be one that I will recommend often. So I know we're talking about getting your services on our website, too. I haven't done that yet, but we definitely have to make sure that parents know about that. And yeah, it's different for what every family needs, for specific areas of support, but some may need to work with you one-on-one to get their child through that, because that's the type of support you need as a parent. And I think going back to that, what you were talking at the beginning, is if we set that example for our kids, we're setting them up for success. And sometimes we're the ones who need the help to get the help that our child needs. So don't forget that either. But yeah, well, thank you so much, Daniel. I appreciated this conversation and just all that you had to share with us. Definitely check out Daniel's book, Helping Your Child with Language-Based Learning Disabilities. And yeah, just all the things that you had to share with us tonight. It's just, it's encouraging and definitely needs to be said a lot.
Well, Peggy, it's been my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me tonight. I've enjoyed speaking with you and to your viewers. And again, I really welcome questions any point in time, even if it's a week, a month, or a year from now, or several years from now, and you're watching this on YouTube. Please feel free to reach out to me, and I welcome your questions.
Yeah, so you can find Daniel at danielfranklinphd.com or franklined.com, and then you can find us at spedhomeschool.com, and you can visit our website. But we just want to thank you for joining us for this broadcast. And it is supported by viewers like you. We are a nonprofit. So if you want to donate to our organization, there's a donate button on our website, and you can check that out. It is tax deductible. But we keep this conversation going all week long, not just Tuesday nights. We have a support group here on Facebook with 2,000 members. And so definitely become part of that conversation, because they're talking about a whole lot of things all the time. So join that group. And then next week, we're going to continue on with the subject of reading. And we're going to be talking with Barbara Steinberg. And she is from PDX Reading Specialists. We're going to talk about ways parents can help a struggling reader. And so we're going to dive into this subject even more next week. And you'll notice all of our blogs this month are about reading too. So different ways to approach issues with struggling readers, and it'll hopefully give you what you need to help your students. So thanks again, everybody, for joining us, and have a good night, and we'll see you next week. Bye, everyone.